We do have a quorum present, and our first bill this morning is the higher education bill. And I'll probably announce it again, but we've communicated with and others that after we complete the higher education bill, we'll be taking a short recess, and the DFL members will be meeting at that point in 400 North. And I'm not sure if the Republicans will be meeting or not. If you do, just feel free to make the announcement. So Representative Bernardi, the higher education finance bill is before us, and we should approve the minutes, however. Representative Olson, the minutes.
Mr. Chair, I move the minutes from April 10th.
Okay, that motion is before us. Any discussion? Hearing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Representative Bernardi, do you have a motion?
Yes, I have a motion. I move the adoption of the Higher Education Finance and Policy Division Report for House File 2544.
Okay, the motion is before us. Any discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carried. Representative Bernardi on the bill. You want to make a motion?
Thank you very much. I say that again. So
I move the bill.
Yes. I move that House File 2544, as amended, be recommended to be placed on the general register.
Okay. And there are no amendments, so Representative Bernardi, would you care to give us an overview of the bill?
Sure. Thank you, Chair Carlson and members. Appreciate being here today. I present to you our Omnibus Higher Education Bill, which provides a fully funded tuition freeze at the University of Minnesota and the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. It also invests $15.4 million in new dollars into the state grant program and also changes policy language, which also adds another $20 million for students to get access over the next biennium. Those increases, currently 80,000 students get participate in the student grant program. Our numbers were told by the Office of Higher Education, 6,000 new students would participate in the next biennium, and that with our changes. And for people going to a full-time to college at a public university would, or actually anywhere at colleges or universities, would get a $400 per year plus in their award for their state grant program. We also provide funding for student mental health services and food access at our Minnesota State campuses, some grants to do that, as well as new funding for open textbook development at Minnesota State to help address the rising costs of books. And then in the new funding for student loan debt counseling that would be available to all Minnesota students and graduates. We also have money in here for the Minnesota Teachers of Color and American Indian Act, which would help to get more teachers in the classroom. And then also it helps strengthen victims' rights, and we have money in a pilot program for blind and our visually impaired teacher training program. That gives you an overview of our proposal.
Okay, are there any questions of Representative Bernardi? Representative Ralph.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and to the author of the bill, and feel free to defer to nonpartisan staff. I haven't noticed this before. It's nothing new, but there's money from the healthcare access fund that's contained in the higher education budget. Can you or defer to staff on what that is and what the origins of that are?
Yes, I will have our staff come down and explain that to the Ways and Means Committee.
Welcome back to the committee.
Chair and members for the tape, Ken Savory, nonpartisan fiscal staff. The question regarding the healthcare access fund, yes, this appropriation has been there since the 90s. It has been an appropriation to the University of Minnesota for specific healthcare purposes.
Mr. Chairman, and do we know what those purposes are?
Mr. Chair and members, I was trying to access the files on my phone, but the email system is down. But I think perhaps the university might be able to add some comments if they're willing on that.
Is there anybody present from the university to answer that question?
Yes, there is.
And Mr. Chairman, for members who are looking, I'm looking at line 153 of the spreadsheet, and it appears it may be. It may be duplicated on line 171.
Welcome.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Brian Burnett. I'm the Senior Vice President for Finance and Operations at the University of Minnesota. The nonpartisan staff member is correct. This has been in the university's appropriation for quite some time, and its origins were to expand the number of physicians and the number of health care providers, particularly for greater Minnesota, and add slots to our medical school. So this was another funding source that your predecessors put in our appropriation with that source to add providers in the rural parts of Minnesota particularly. And as you may know, we have one of the larger medical schools in the United States in terms of the number of students and number of doctors we turn out each year. This is part of the funding along with state tax support to help us turn out the number of doctors we do for the state.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And so when you say it's used for those purposes, this pays for instructors, it pays for financial aid for students. I don't recall ever saying this before. I don't dispute it. It's been there since the 90s, but it's new to me, and I'm curious.
Mr. Chairman and sir, the number of faculty is governed by accreditation. So whenever you add slots to the medical school to be able to turn out more physicians for the state, you have to have a certain ratio. And so this, along with state support, along with tuition, goes into a general operations or an O&M budget for the medical school to make sure we have the appropriate number of faculty to turn out trained physicians that are under an accredited program. So it would go in that total pot to help have the bandwidth and the number of faculty and support services to turn out physicians.
Yeah, thank you. And I would just comment, I happen to have been on that committee for several years, and for several biennium of big issue was what we could do to get more medical doctors and other healthcare professionals in some of our smaller communities in greater Minnesota, and this is one attempt. University of Minnesota Duluth, when it was created, that was a major part of their mission as well. And in addition to the funding, the university made attempts to recruit a lot of potential students from greater Minnesota, the feeling being that they perhaps would go back. And I remember in the 1970s when I would travel through parts of Minnesota. In fact, I used to teach in St. Charles, Minnesota, and I had the local doctor's son in class. And a couple of years later after I left there, there was a sign up, doctor wanted. So either it was too much for that one doctor in town or he had moved. But at any rate, it was a big issue in greater Minnesota. And I think if I recall correctly, this funding was an attempt to address that.
Representative Carlson, that is still the case today. And the Duluth campus is a big provider of physicians for greater Minnesota to this day. And you're absolutely correct. This was an attempt to get more physicians in the greater Minnesota area.
Representative Hamlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To that point, I'm curious, since this program started, how many trained physicians have located out in greater Minnesota?
Carlson, Representative Hamill, I'm sorry, I don't have that data, but I'll get it for you. I think we've actually seen better coverage from physicians around the state with this program, the partnership with the legislature. We'll get you that data. We would say that about 70% of the practicing physicians in the state of Minnesota were trained at the University of Minnesota, which is one of the highest rates for a state school in the country. And if you think about the geographic spread of the state, that's pretty impressive. But we'll get you that data. We think we've got a good story to tell, and we're very appreciative of the legislature's support of it.
It's old information, but when I was referencing the University of Minnesota Duluth, at least years ago, they had information that the program was working well. I remember some of the testimony. It wasn't perfect, you know, that some that they assumed might practice in greater Minnesota for other reasons, perhaps, that were personal. They ended up practicing you know, in a larger community. But at least back then, overall, things were going quite well. Representative.
Yeah. And thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm grateful we have a program like this because we continue to struggle in some locations finding physicians or having them locate out in rural Minnesota. So, yeah, if the testifier could give me that information, that'd be very helpful. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And then for Representative Bernardi, or if she wishes to defer to nonpartisan staff, the tuition freeze mechanism, can you elaborate how we have the authority to tell schools what they can charge for tuition or what they cannot, or kind of explain how that arrangement works?
Thank you. For our state university, our state colleges and universities, we have the authority to do that as a legislature, and our and as the for the regents who govern our land grant institution, we are requesting that they do that, and we have worked with them on coming up with a budget that would freeze tuition at all of the university campuses, University of Minnesota campuses across the state.
So, Mr. Chairman, so that line 133 of the budget, is that all encompassing for all the state schools as well as the University of Minnesota?
Mr. Chair and members, I believe Representative Garofalo is referring to line 133 of the larger three-page spreadsheet. That
I can answer
those
that.
Dollars.
I can answer that. I mean, I can answer that. That would be
Representative Minardi.
That those dollars include the entire that allows a tuition freeze. It's not just the tuition freeze, it includes all the budget, the dollars that go to the University of Minnesota that would include a tuition freeze across all of its campuses.
So, Mr. Chairman and Representative Bernardi, so where's the tuition freeze for the state colleges then? What line is that?
Okay, so they're probably up higher by, wait just a second, what line is that? On the second, it would probably be on the second page, and then it goes in line 82, I believe. I got to look to see the numbers in front of us, and our house research person probably has the numbers at his, which line item it is. I'm not. Okay, I got it. But anyway, the change items, is that where it would tell them as?
Yes, Mr. Chair and members, to clarify, line 98, so line 97 lists change items for Minnesota State, and then line 98 references a $65 million increase in fiscal year 20 and then a $93.4 million increase in fiscal year 21 for the Minnesota State trustees, and that is a campus investment. So that is, those are dollars that are added to the overall operations and maintenance appropriation that exists for Minnesota State.
So, Mr. Chairman, and first of all, you know, I want to make sure we're all working off the same spreadsheet. I'm looking at April 10th, 2019, 8:34 a.m. Are we all working off the same document?
Yes.
Okay, thank
yes.
you. So, Mr. Chairman and members, so line 98 under the state colleges, the tuition freeze is called campus investments, and then line 133 is where we actually separate it out as tuition freeze for the University of Minnesota. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and members, yes, that is correct. I will add that it's a stylistic difference between both the Minn State section of the bill and the University of Minnesota section of the bill. The University of Minnesota section of the bill, there's a rider within the O&M appropriation that specifies dollars that are meant to go for a specific tuition freeze. But in the Minnesota State section, because of the legislature's different relationship with the Minnesota State trustees in which they can instruct them to freeze tuition, there is no number specified in the bill for that specific purpose.
Okay. And so, Mr. Chairman, to staff, is the so the appropriation on line 133, is that 100% dedicated then to covering the cost of the tuition freeze?
Mr. Chairman, members, yes, the bill specifies that those dollars are meant to be used to keep tuition flat.
And then, Mr. Chairman, and to Chairman Hardy or staff, the 159 for campus investments, is it correct in saying that that goes beyond, that's not just the tuition freeze, that it includes new spending for other areas?
Representative Garofalo, did you say 159 or?
Yeah, line 98, page okay. 2 of the spreadsheet. Okay. The $159 million that's spent there, is that the cost of the tuition freeze or are there other? Is there spending involved in that beyond just tuition replacement?
So, Mr. Chairman, members, the line 98 is references an increase to the operations and maintenance appropriation, and I imagine the chaired conversations with Minnesota State regarding the amount of dollars that would be feasible to freeze tuition as well as cover inflationary costs related to staffing, fringe benefits, things of that nature. And so that those dollars in that particular column represent an increase to the operations and maintenance appropriations, which coincidentally would freeze tuition.
So, Mr. Chairman, Representative Bernardi, of that $159 million, how much of that is the, I'll use the term cost, but how much of that is the paying for a tuition freeze?
I do not have that breakout, but I know that there's $10,000 in that line item that goes to the next generation project that they're doing to have a computer system that is functional for the Minnesota State Colleges. So it is totally inclusive. The $149,000 of that line and $98,000 is for operations and maintenance to fund the Minnesota State system and freeze tuition.
So,
Representative Groflin, I assume Representative Bernardi, you meant million.
What's that? Oh, well, sorry. Excuse me. Sorry, Chair. Thank you.
Who would have thought that County Bernardi would be slashing education budget to $149,000? That's just wow. It's
oh, sorry.
No. So that
she well within her target.
Yeah, she would. And so, what's the way for us to find out how much of that? So we'll separate the $10 million out from the set aside within that. Of the $149 million, what's the best way for us to find out how much of that is paying for the tuition freeze? Do we have a representative from?
Sure.
We have someone from Minnesota State coming down to help with that question.
Welcome, Ms. King, and this may be your last time before Ways and Means. I'm sure everybody's aware that, in June you retire?
Correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay, well, thank you for your service.
Thank you very much.
Did you hear the question?
I did, thank you, yes. I don't have the current spreadsheet in front of me, but to the question of the way the bill is constructed, as the Chair introduced it, the cost to us of the tuition freeze is $149 million. The $159 that is showing that I heard cited includes the $10 million added for our ERP replacement project. Mm-hmm. For the tape, Laura King, Vice Chancellor of Minnesota State Colleges and Universities.
And so, Mr. Chairman, so the full $149 million is offsetting any increase in tuition?
Mr. Chair, yes, that's correct.
And so for the state colleges, that number is 149, and for the University of Minnesota, that number is 114. Line 133, so it's $114 million for the University of Minnesota for the tuition freeze. And I'm using the term cost, Mr. Chairman, but I think that's we have to pay for these bills as they go forward. So the $114 million for the tuition freeze for the University of Minnesota, $149 for all the state colleges in our state. How does that compare in terms of the ratio of enrollment? So we take a look at this right here. We see a total of $263 million. Roughly $114 million of that goes to the University of Minnesota. Just doing a round percentage of that, I think that works out to about, 40%? 40% of the overall budget of that total amount. Does state college enrollment match up to 20% more than the University of Minnesota's enrollment?
Mr. Chair, Representative, and I'll defer to the university. I think the university enrollment's about 65,000. The state college and university enrollment is about 240,000.
So, Mr. Chairman, and so even though the state colleges are about four times the student population, the cost of a tuition freeze is only 20% more.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the tuition rates are different between us and the University of Minnesota. And if there's interest in a more extended analytical framing of this, we could certainly work with the university to do that.
Sure. And, Mr. Chairman, and of course, we're talking about obviously very different tuition rates for locations, but as it's a dollars and cents perspective, that even though state college enrollment is roughly four times as much, the cost to freeze tuition at the University of Minnesota versus state colleges is only 20% more. So it is, we get a lot more bang for the buck tuition, freezing tuition at state colleges than we do at the University of Minnesota. And I'm aware that there's different tuition rates, but I don't believe the University of Minnesota has a tuition schedule that's four times that on average of state colleges. So just if that's why if the 149 and the 114 are accurate numbers, I'm trying to figure out how there can be such a huge discrepancy in the cost of freezing tuition.
Okay. Ms. King has said that they can do a little work on this to help answer Representative Garofalo's question.
Okay. I mean, Mr. Chairman, am I right, though, that that seems like a very large discrepancy given the student population sizes? Or are the state colleges having fewer full-time students? Are there more part-time students? Are there fewer credit loads? That's a very large discrepancy. And I'm not implying that the university doesn't need this money to freeze tuition or that this somehow the state colleges are to be asking for more money. That seems like a very large discrepancy between student count and tuition freeze availability.
Mr. Chair, Representative, this is worthy of more than I can give you on the spot here. There is a lot about Minnesota State Colleges and Universities that's different from the University of Minnesota. I think the state is well organized in the way they've established different kinds of colleges and universities for different parts of the service to the state. So there's a lot about us that contrasts quite a bit. And I would prefer to do a little work here with the university staff rather than offering a general opinion on the spot.
That's fair. Mr. Chairman, thank you. I appreciate that. So maybe it might be helpful for members of the committee, either from nonpartisan staff or from university sources, to provide the three following pieces of information. Number one is, what is the total amount of tuition revenue that goes to state colleges, and what is the total amount of tuition revenue that goes to University of Minnesota schools? Included in that tuition revenue, I assume, would be financial aid payments. So that would be considered part of the tuition number. So I think that'd be a good piece of information to have to separate. We have the student count information, but also this total tuition, total revenue that's coming in via students on the tuition side for both those. The second is to confirm the attendance of each of those institutions. And then third and finally is to compare the 114 and the 149, how those dollars are actually being allocated to the university, to those institutions. You know, how are those dollars being spent? What are they being used for? I know in the spreadsheet they show up as tuition freeze or as campus investments. I think it would be good for members of the committee to know beyond those descriptions of how those dollars are being spent. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You're welcome. And just a comment. You know, there are times when we've had discussions like this, even within Minnesota State system. I remember I used to ask questions about why the funding level was different between one state university and another. And when we looked at that, it narrowed down, if you will, to the types of programs that were on a given campus. You know, one campus might have an engineering school and another one not. And, for example, engineering is quite expensive to be offering that. And without getting into it, I think Ms. King said she would follow up with some of that. But it is a complex area when you begin to dig into it. Our earlier conversations were more often than not comparing the funding per student at times when it would be before the committee. And then you had the internal reallocation, and that's where sometimes one university would say, well, why do we get less per student than the other state university? And when we would ask the campus leadership about it, then it often boiled down to program.
Mr. Chairman,
at any rate, we could spend a lot of time on that. If they can get back to you, that would be great.
No, just Mr. Chairman, there are other members of the committee who have spoken about this in previous sessions that tuition is kind of an easy way to raise revenue for the university to raise revenue and spend generally as it sees fit. And we're not even talking about student fees. So I just know other people have highlighted in the past that there seems to have been a disproportional growth in the amount of central administration compared to student populations in the state, and I think those concerns were valid. And just wanted to, again, I'd like to see the dollar amount, the three questions I asked earlier. And I don't know, Mr. Chairman, who is responsible for getting those answers to those three questions? Did you delegate that to nonpartisan staff, or do we just rely on Mr. Mark?
Interpreting that Ms. King said that she would work with the university.
Correct.
To get back to us. Is that
correct? And we'll work with the chair staff. And we'll provide an answer back to you, Representative
Price. Yes, but it goes beyond the University of Minnesota. It would be the state universities as well.
Well, she's here representing the Minnesota state, and she's their director of finance. We've got Mr. Bennett in the audience that I think has heard the questions, and he said yes. So I assume there will be some conversation between the two systems, and they'll be getting back.
Yes.
If that satisfies, it's really in the purview of the chair of the higher ed committee. So,
thank you very much.
Thank you, and thank you, Mr.
Chair.
Shaking
her head, yes. That
they say they can do that and get back to us. That would be
certainly.
Just a quick comment. There was a fellow that was a longtime member of our legislative staff that later became Vice President of Finance at the University of Minnesota, and when we would have discussions about tuition, Mr. Fitzenreiter would say, you really should talk about the cost of attendance, tuition being just one component for food for thought. And freezing tuition is a very important goal, but you touched Representative Garofalo a little bit on when you talked about fees and so on. All of that would go into the total cost of attendance, which is a very different question sometimes than just tuition. Right, Dr. King?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. There is a relationship, but it's larger than just the tuition question.
And the financial aid, by the way, looks at the cost of attendance when those grants are being given out. That's why that discussion is important. Well, any further questions? Oh, Representative Nelson, you've been waiting quite a while. Okay. Representative Pulaski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to try to clarify this just a little bit. We're talking about undergraduate tuition, and there are two ways to freeze tuition. One is you assume that the percentages that are presented to you when you review the budgets of the universities are accurate, and that those numbers indeed do freeze tuition and the students don't bear the burden of an increased cost, and that is how you apply whatever your target is to freeze tuition. And that's what we did in 2013. We froze tuition at the numbers after reviewing those numbers exhaustively in 14 hearings without having a bill in front of us, just budget accounts. And then we did freeze tuition, and there was no increased cost to the student, and there was no increased student debt. Subsequent legislatures have done this. They've frozen tuition and not paid for it. You can do it that way. If you do it that way, then there are some interesting cuts and shifts that occur within the two systems, particularly within the MnState system, and I'm not going to review that here, but it was an interesting way of balancing budgets if you do not pay the price of tuition increases. So we're looking at undergraduate. We're looking at two methods, and this method says we're going to freeze tuition and pay for it, and we're not going to increase student debt. And this is the other big issue. The last time I checked, we were fourth and fifth in the nation in the amount of debt students carry in Minnesota and in the number of students that carry debt. And I would argue that this is the fifth big fiscal crisis of this country. Student debt now exceeds credit card debt across the country. There are students that graduate that can't afford to have a family, can't afford to have a house, can't afford to have a car simply because they're paying student debt. So I would hope that this bill does what we did in 2013. It pays and freezes tuition so there is no increased student debt in the undergraduate programs at the University of Minnesota and at MnState. That's what the bill does.
Do we have Representative Lowe?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chair Bernardi, for bringing this forward. I think I was going to talk about some of what Representative Pawlowski, and actually congratulate him on when he froze it. And this is a huge thing for Minnesota, and it's I think it's something that we all can go home and say, because it's real. I mean, the students are bearing this, like Representative Pawlowski just said, so I'm not going to reiterate that. But there is some kind of neat, innovative things that are in this bill, and like the open book program is in there, trying to buy down some of these other costs for students. And there's a program in here that you're doing, which I think is really neat for, you know, many of our students struggle with food insecurity. And just so you've kind of stepped up. That's unusual, you know, that we would do that, I think. But I think it's neat that you're addressing that. And then you've added in some mental health and then helping students in different ethnic group or not minority groups, and helping them become successful. And a lot of those programs are pretty neat. And then earlier we heard people talk about, you know, students all over the state, and you've got a lot of great stuff in there and that. So I think it's a very good bill, and I'm pretty excited about it.
And we have Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bernardi, what has happened with enrollment numbers in each of these two organizations? What's the trend been? What's percentages, increases, decreases, or flat?
I'm going to ask both of the institutions to come down. I could speak for them, but I want them to answer that question for you. And as they come down, I wanted to make Representative Pawlowski made that very clear. This is for 2- and 4-year universities and colleges, public colleges across the state of Minnesota, for the tuition freeze.
Mr. Burnett, you want to go first?
Chair Carlson and members of the committee.
Bennett earlier, Burnett.
On behalf of the University of Minnesota, our enrollments are fairly steady. The Twin Cities campus has been steady for quite some time. We've been down a little bit in Crookston and Morris, and a little bit down in Duluth, and Rochester continues to grow as our youngest campus. But overall, we're around 67,000 students across our 5 campuses. That's holding pretty steady. There's some dips in graduate, some ups in undergraduate, but we have a lot of graduate professional programs on top of the undergrad program at the University of Minnesota as the state's land grant and research university. So we're fairly steady in enrollment, with some exceptions in our greater Minnesota campuses.
Representative Skalski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what was the is it 67,000 today? What was the enrollment 5 years ago?
You can give me 1 second. I believe it was close to $67,000.
I'm not ready either.
Based on the data that I have with me, it's roughly the same, within 1,000 students of where it was 5 years ago.
Is that undergrad, or is there a break?
Well, I'd have to get you all that data. Again, we have 5 campuses, undergrad and grad, in the Twin Cities.
Can you get that information
sure.
to us,
uh-huh.
Broken out by graduate and undergraduate? Can we have the amounts of each of those for, say, each of the last 10 years, and then this year, and the projections over each of the next 4 years that you might have? I'm sure you do enrollment projections as well. How about MinSCU?
So just to be clear,
university.
So 10 years back and 4 years ahead, is that what I understand?
Mr. Chair, what I would ask for is each individual year over the last 10 years.
Okay.
Every single year over the last 10 years, what has the enrollment been? What is it this year? What is it projected to be each of the next 4 years?
And just briefly, generally, it'll be steady. The university isn't planning any big change or any big contraction, but I will tell you it's not going to vary much.
The paper will reflect that.
We'll get that for you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Mr. Chair, MinSCU?
Minnesota State, you requested as well.
Minnesota State. I stand corrected. I remember that, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
I didn't hear what you had said.
I said MinSCU. I was
they changed, you know. They.
That was my point.
They struggled for about 25 years.
That was my point. I struggled, too, but now I'm done struggling. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And I'll editorial a bit. I think when they went with Minnesota State, they added to confusion because you had, like, Minnesota State, Mankato, and one thing and another, and Personally, I think they should have stayed with Minsky. Everybody understood that, but that's just my editorial for the day. And in fact, I asked the president of Cato, I said about that change, and he said, well, it's still MSU. at any rate, my editorial for the day.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And I think you were responsible for the name change, were you?
I was not.
Okay.
Yes. I was a party to it, and I support it, and I think it's worked well. But I appreciate the fact that it was a long time when we were known otherwise. To the question of our enrollment in fiscal 19, we're projecting 126,000 full-year equivalents, which translates to about 240 individuals because our students are substantially part-time. That contrasts with 2009. So 10 years prior, we were at 143,900 full-year equivalents, so a decrease of about 20,000 full-year equivalents from the height of the recession to today. We do not do four-year forward projections. We have two-year forward projections, and 2 years out in fiscal 21, we're currently projecting 126,000 full-year equivalents.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Ms. King, could you provide the same information that the University of Minnesota is going to provide, kind of those same numbers?
I can provide 10 years past and 2 years forward. Okay. We don't have 4 years forward.
We'll take whatever we can get. Both graduate and undergraduate?
Certainly.
And then also, and I would request this both of you and the university, could you get resident and non-resident numbers in there as well?
I believe so, yes.
Okay.
Because we are largely not charging a non-resident tuition rate, I'm not sure what kind of status our non-resident data is, but I'll look into it.
Okay, and I assume the University of Minnesota can provide the same. Thank you. Mr. Chair, I hope we can maybe between that data and the nonpartisan staff, we could actually have over a similar trend, the amount of state taxpayer money that has been spent per student as well. That would be, I would think, easy to compute once we get those numbers from the university. And actually, I would expect maybe the committee had those numbers in their deliberations as they work through this budget. But if they would, Madam Chair, Bernardi, if you have those, or if staff can develop those along with the two university systems, I think that would be very helpful and instructive for us. Chair Bernardi, as you put this budget together, it looks like for operating and maintenance for the University of Minnesota, it's about a 9% increase projected over the biennium of the amount of the people's money that we're going to contribute to the Minn State system, and then U of M, and then Minn State was about a 12% increase. 11.7 projected increase in their operations and maintenance. What amount has each of these university systems contributed in the form of reductions in staff or other reductions in costs in order to help contribute to this tuition freeze? Are we simply taking more and more taxpayer money to pay this down, to pay the tuition freeze?
Mr. Chair, I know the University of Minnesota has $33 million planned in their reallocations to be able to participate in this tuition freeze. And that's what I understand. I do not know from the Minnesota State University. I do know that Minnesota State statute has the state will cover two-thirds of a student's public education in the state, and one-third be covered by the student and two-thirds would be covered by the state. The last numbers I got from the office of, you can help me with this, Mr. Chair, the Midwest
Higher Education Compact.
Right. We just were at a meeting, it was a bipartisan meeting, with that group, and they show that it's now in Minnesota, instead of being the 33-66 split in Minnesota, now students are covering over 50% of their college education, and the state is, I don't have the exact numbers, but it's in the it's in the 40% now. Just wanted to share that with you.
So Mr. Chair and Representative Bernardi, so the University of Minnesota has, you said, 33 million of reallocation. I don't know what that means. But have they actually found some cuts? I know they've been actively building buildings over there, and I know that was part of the discussion last biennium during the capital investment discussion, using some of their resources to build buildings. I'm wondering if we are giving them all of this additional taxpayer money, are they using their own resources to build buildings? Or what's going on over there?
These resources are not to build, Mr. Chair, these resources are not to build buildings. If the University of Minnesota would like to come down, they're welcome to. But this budget is not meant, it's not to build buildings, and it's not used for that.
The capital investment building or bill was reported out of that division this morning, and we'll be having that up in the future, and maybe you want to talk about funding the building with Representative Ruskowski at that point.
Yeah, my question, Mr. Chair, would be, can you tell us, are you using any internal monies to build buildings over there on any of the U of M campuses at this time that would be or would not be, or would be in within or included as part of a capital investment effort here at the legislature or not, or outside of it as well?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we do use our own sources for, it depends on the type of building you're talking about. If it's a residence life or a dormitory, there's no state money in that, and that's all the university either borrowing or cash balances to build buildings like that. This state has had a history of partnering with the university and with the Minnesota state system on capital projects where the state provides two-thirds of the project, and we provide one-third either through donations or through our own resources. And that's going on now as we build the new health sciences education center that the state has funded, and it's under construction as we speak. We just finished a building in Duluth, the chemistry building, excuse me. That building has just been opened, and that was a two-third state, one-third university coming up with it. So there's a variety of ways that we fund our capital program, but this bill in front of you today is around, as Representative Bernardi said, is around the operations and maintenance budget, essentially how we pay our employees and how we fund the university's ongoing operations.
So, Mr. Chair, I'm wondering if the U of M could provide for us a list of all of their building projects for each of the last 5 years, and maybe what's planned for the next 4 years as well, and where the monies either came from or are coming from, and what the split would have been between the U of M and the state taxpayers outside of the U of M through this place here. Could that be provided to the committee?
Mr. Chairman, yes, sir, we can provide that for you.
Okay. Thank you. That's all I have, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
You've given them a lot of homework. Representative Scott. Oh, you're off.
Actually, I do
have it. Oh, you want to be on it?
Thank you. Scott. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not sure I heard the answer to Representative Joskowski's question as to what the two different systems, the U and Minnesota State, are doing. And I'm not on higher ed. I've never been on higher ed. I don't understand exactly how this works, but you know, we have these tuition freezes and the state pays for it. What skin in the game do the two university systems have in freezing tuition? What do they do to buckle down?
Okay.
Thank
you. University is
getting your lifelines back.
Yes, exactly. They're coming back. Here they are.
Maybe they can just hang closer until we vote the bill out.
Right.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, so the university in putting its budget together when we worked with Chair Bernardi is planning over the biennium, as she noted, over $30 million in internal reallocations or reductions to programs to help fund utility increases, pay raises for employees, pay raises for our faculty, and all the changes in operating costs that come. Tuition is a very big piece of how we fund the university. It's a big piece of how we fund Minnesota State. So for a little bit of clarification, of the $114 million, what we had proposed in our budget request from the Regents was an $87 million biennial increase. with a 2% tuition increase on top of that. Well, that equals around $27 million. So you put the two numbers together, we would not do a 2% resident tuition increase to help fund the needed costs over the biennium of the university. And so that's how you get to the tuition freeze number, and that's how you get to what we're putting in to also reduce the demand for state tax dollars or student tuition dollars to fund the budget next, over the next 2 years.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could have a follow-up question for that gentleman first.
Okay.
And so the $87 million that you mentioned, is that over base?
Mr. Chairman, yes, it is over the base. It's a base increase.
Okay. Okay. Thank you. The Minsky, or I'm sorry. This is the same good answer.
I understand. I often
it
say
Minsky. Minsky rolls off the tongue. I don't know.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. In the case of Minnesota State, our budget request assumed as part of our regular budget management, $35 million in annual reallocations. As we reported to the Higher Education Committee recently, just over the last 4 years, we've reallocated about $145 million. We do that just as a matter of good management as we're putting budgets together. We do that through closing programs, through eliminating positions. Our headcount is down about 10% just in the last 4 or 5 years. We, as of fiscal 17 data, I believe, are 41st in the country in administrative spending, and we have run a very tight administrative program in order to protect the investments in the classroom. And we do that through reallocations.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so the $145 million right, reallocation. Can you expound on that a little bit more?
Certainly. All of our college and university budgets are managed by local budget processes. The presidents have strategic authority to establish programs and areas of student services. And in doing that, they identify programs that demand has fallen off on, and they close those programs. And we call that a reallocation. They might take the funds associated with that program and use them to start a new program, or they might take them as part of a budget reduction exercise.
Thank you.
And Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just after having lengthy discussion, I just going back to what this tuition freeze in terms of the dollar amount means. When I sent out my first legislative survey, I was surprised. I knew student debt was a big issue in my district. But I was surprised at how many couples were moving into my district and buying their first home but weren't having kids. And the thing they were saying that has so much impact was their student debt. And thinking about how that impacts our public school enrollment, how it impacts our workforce. And so just reminding folks when we talk about these tuition freezes what this means for not just state dollars but what impact it has on the people that we serve and how big of our systems play into all of the elements of what we talk about with our state budget, and this is a big piece of that. So I just wanted to remind folks about that, and also say go UMD Bulldogs.
I think I'll recognize Representative Garofalo, and we have an ambitious agenda today. So I think we'll take the vote after. I assume, Dean, that we've kind of set the tone in previous meetings that you'll do your conclusion from your side of the aisle. Is that where we're at?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you. Representative Graffel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And earlier, my respected colleague, Representative Pawlowski, laid out two different ways to do things, and I certainly appreciate when people present a binary choice to me of one way or another. But there is a third way, of course, Representative Pawlowski and others, and that is that the efficiencies, the financial incentives for efficiencies that exist in the private sector are somehow imported or exported into the public sector. They simply just don't exist right now. The reality is that productivity gains, productivity enhancements are primarily driven by system redesign, by automation, by self-improvement, self-instruction, educational redesign. These are all big picture items that get away from this quaint notion that for students to learn, they have to be in the same physical building as someone else they're learning from, and they have to learn at the exact same pace and scope as other people. Differentiated learning on an individual basis is the great equalizer with internet and broadband, with internet and remote learning. And so for the large part, our institutions in Minnesota, their primary expense, their number one cost is paying salary and benefits for adults. That's what they do. and that is very difficult to bring automation and efficiencies into those systems and reduce those counts because of the constituency groups involved. That's just a reality of the situation. It's why right now in the state of Minnesota we have more students majoring in journalism than there are journalism jobs in the state of Minnesota. That's how we end up with that disconnect about what's happening and what students are being served for what purposes. And so going forward, as this is the same thing, it's a bigger conversation than what budget targets are. Going forward, it's the same thing with health care. It's the same thing with other items. Government needs to be providing better services at a lower cost. And that lower cost doesn't come from transfers or moving money from one pocket to another. It comes from delivering true efficiencies with better technology deployment and fewer employees working in the areas. That's, to quote a famous journalist, that's reality check. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Pawlowski, you ended up putting...
Well, Mr. Chair, I just wanted your response since he was addressing me, and I couldn't agree more with Representative Garofalo because in 2013 when we froze tuition, there were items in the bill that were signed into law by Governor Dayton that included the following. We eliminated all bonuses for administrators in the MnState system because they are the highest paid administrators. And up to then, they were making such wonderful decisions as we can raise tuition. We can raise tuition. Well, we can raise tuition. We also had language in the bill that said before you cut faculty and program, you cut administration. Again, something agreeable to Governor Dayton. So I'm in full agreement with you. I think when we're having these bills, particularly when we're freezing tuition, there should be a corollary involved in this, that there is something stated that there has to be a revision or a reallotment of resources in some areas which no longer would be needed if we are putting resources to the students and we are saying we're freezing tuition. But I'm going to emphasize again this debt issue. This debt issue is the biggest issue since Wall Street, since the banks, since the automotive, and since we real estate fell. This is the next one. And if we don't address it somehow, we're going to be in deep trouble. So I'm in agreement with you, Representative Garofalo.
Even though we had the concluding comments, I guess, Representative Druskowski, can you be brief?
Yeah, I'm going to speak on behalf of the Newhouse Republican Caucus, Mr. Chair. So I'm just wondering, I'd like to add to my list, if I could, to our two university reps. Can we get on that table also the number of faculty FTEs for each of the last 10 years and then projections for each of the next four, too, which certainly should include those reallocations that you mentioned to us if those indeed resulted in faculty changes. Can those be included as well? And then also, could we get them by the middle next week? Is that too ambitious?
That's fine.
Yes, sir.
They're shaking their head, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
With that, Representative Minardi, would you like to renew your motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to renew my motion that House File 2544, as amended, be recommended to be placed on the general register.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, then, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carried. We put out notice, and I announced again at the beginning of the meeting that we would take a short, probably 30-minute recess. The DFL members will be meeting in room 400 North. Representative Garofalo?
272.
272. Okay, with that, we are in recess. I'd like to reconvene the Ways and Means Committee, and the first bill we'll have up is the disaster relief bill by Representative Pawlowski. And Representative Pawlowski reminds me that this is one of the longer bills that we're going to have today. So if you could present the bill and maybe...
Mr. Chair, I think I better move the adoption of the Greater Minnesota Economic Development Finance Division report for House File 2611.
Okay, that motion is before us. Any discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye. 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 Opposed? Motion.
Then, Mr. Chair, I move that House File 2611 be recommended to be placed on the general register.
Okay, that motion is before us, Representative Pawlowski.
And then I'm going to move the A1 amendment, and the A1 amendment would clarify that this is a one-time transfer. It would also double the length of the bill. So, Mr. Chair, we had, until the amendment, a new record for omnibus bills, one sentence. I had set the previous record in 2014 in higher ed with a two-sentence omnibus bill for higher ed. I'm going to tie that record now if this amendment goes on and should the bill proceed for the shortest omnibus bill,
so,
two sentences.
Representative Pawlowski, I made my comments too soon then when I talked about how short the bill was going to be. You've down doubled the size.
Yeah, that's true, Mr. Chair, and I didn't want to embarrass you.
Okay. And Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the amendment, Representative Pawlowski, the word one time, I know it's not your subject area, but it looks kind of weird to me. Did you check in with Representative Erickson to make sure we're spelling one time correctly?
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, I try to keep my spelling corrections. This isn't actually my document, but I do watch spelling, as you've noticed. Even last night on a certain document, there was an interesting anomaly with the spelling of my name. So I watch it very closely.
Okay, we need to vote on the amendment. Any discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried.
Mr. Chair, the bill is the final bill in the number of discussions we've had with various disasters over this legislative session, but these are natural disasters that we're dealing with today. I don't have a hand up, but I do have a reminder for the committee. In the last 21 years, we've had 16 special sessions. And to remind the committee, there is nothing special about a special session. When we compress everything down to a day or a couple of days, we invariably make mistakes and errors. What this does is ensure that when we do address a disaster, we will have the totality of the cost and the numbers will be correct, and we will be able to get aid to those areas as quickly as possible should there be a presidential declaration, a gubernatorial declaration of a disaster. So this would allow us to proceed over the interim and address those disasters that hopefully won't be coming, but invariably will be coming. So that's basically the bill, Mr. Chair.
Okay, any discussion on the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the author of the bill, Representative Pawlowski, you and I have a long and somewhat storied past with regard to disasters of a natural design, not of our own doing. But I want to thank you for your founding preparation of both chapters, and appreciate the candor and also the vigilance to watch over those with the manner in which you've done that. And I look forward to working with you in the future on other related matters.
Mr. Chair, and Representative Albright, Representative Albright brought forward an issue that occurred in his district with a disaster that had happened, and I want to remind members that nothing's perfect, and we do not know what types of disasters are going to come before us. So when they come, and when we do have anomalies, we're going to have to address them and do modifications like we did with Representative Albright. And just a reminder to everyone, we have local units of governments. We have townships, counties, school districts, cities. All of these various entities do have a playbook, but there are things that happen that are not anticipated. So to Representative Albright, I'm glad that we had the discussion and we made the changes, but there invariably will be future changes that we're going to have to be made as we proceed.
Okay, we have Representative Davis.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Representative Pawlowski. This is very necessary. Our area has lived through some very serious disasters, and because of your work, you've made it a lot more, you've made it much better when we're in these situations. So thank you for your work, and I'm going to be very happy to vote yes on this one. Thank you, Representative Pawlowski.
Okay, any further discussion? This is one that will be folded in, so I'll temporarily lay the bill over then. Thank you, Representative
Thank
Pawlowski.
You, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
We go now to the Judiciary Finance Bill. Representative Lesch and We need a couple of motions, Representative Lesh. Will Representative Noor?
Mr. Chair, members, I move adoption of the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Division report for House File 2705.
Okay, that motion is before us. Any discussion? Seeing that, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion carried. Representative Noor?
Mr. Chair, I move that House File 2705, as amended, be recommended to be placed on the General Register.
Okay, the motion is before us. Representative Lesh, there are no amendments, so if you could explain the bill.
I will. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, the Omnibus Judiciary Finance Bill this year for 20 and 21, the base, we are $91.4 million over base for a total of $1.47 billion. We essentially, what we did is we funded the governor's budget request, supplemental budget request, with a few additions that we pay for by raising civil and probate fees by $50 and adding a court data breach prevention fee of $1. That latter raises $400,000. The changes from the governor's asks are House File 1784, Representative Cantrell, which is an early neutral evaluation study from the University of Minnesota to determine the effectiveness of how we're doing early neutral evaluations in family law cases. Second, we gave the district court judges 1% above the 3% ask from the courts. The reason for this is because of the lag that district court judges have experienced since those lean years of 2003 to 2007. They fell behind everyone else. The original ask from the governor for the courts was 3.5% across the board for both years. The judges were asking for 5. The district court judges were asking for 5. The supplemental dropped that request to 3 and 3, and we funded the district court judges at 4, and we also do this with the civil and probate filing fee increase. The total cost is $7.3 million on that. There's an additional 2% one-time increase to Public Defense Board. This really, I think, has been the committee's top priority for funding due to the extraordinary caseloads that public defenders have to work through in Minnesota, as well as the low salaries they experience. The fourth one is civil asset forfeiture. This cost $720,000 in 2021 and $1.3 million in 2022-23. This is due to the revenue loss from various accounts. It is we maintain that civil asset forfeiture, law enforcement taking your stuff, is an issue, but we also recognize that law enforcement uses that money for some good stuff. So that's what the cost accounts for. The next, number 5, we have the Commission on Intelligence and Technology. This is so that the legislature can take a look at new technologies coming online that may affect your privacy or may risk individual citizens' data breaches, and we can get a handle on that ahead of time so we're not constantly reacting to it and chasing after it, which is what the legislature's been doing for the last 12 years. Next is private cooperative divorce. If you and your spouse can agree on the terms, you can reach an agreement under Minnesota law without having to spend tens of thousands of dollars on attorney's fees. Next, criminal traffic surcharge. One of the things we did, Mr. Chair and members, back in those lean years also, is we stacked a surcharge upon everyone's fines and fees that is now at $76. The judges are not allowed to waive to indigent defendants. Quite frankly, what happens is they're not able to pay that, so their license gets suspended, and they drive around with a suspended license, and they get picked off for that, and they draw another court appearance for that. So this allows judges to waive that for indigent defendants and has the associated costs with that. Next, there's Representative Beckerfin's House File 113, the Ramsey County fine revenue. Members, every other city in the state, if you prosecute something, you get two-thirds. Minneapolis gets 80%, incidentally. But for some reason, the Ramsey County suburban cities get one-half. So they were complaining about that, justly we thought, and that accounts for the $346,000. And then how we pay for this, Mr. Chair and members, is, as I stated previously, the civil and probate filing fee increase of $50 and the court data
breach prevention fee of $1. There are several policy bills included herein as well. Am I speaking to those, Mr. Chair, or are we just talking about the finance part of this?
Well, we kind of leave it up to the presenter, but remember, it is the Finance Committee.
Well, I'll hold off, and I'll answer questions on them in case people have, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
That's it.
Okay, any discussion? Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks, Representative Lash, Chair Lash, for running a good committee. This isn't a bill that's highly controversial. There are a couple of things in it that are troublesome, but overall I think it's a decent bill, and it does spend more money than than in the past years, but I just I want to thank Representative Lash for putting some really good provisions in the bill. I think the forfeiture piece, we learned this earlier this week that might still need a little bit of work during conference committees and so forth. And so I know that you're willing to work on that, and I appreciate you bringing the bill. Thank you.
Any further discussion? Representative Groff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. This bill, it looks like the target for this committee, as was stated by Chairman Lesh, is $91 million above base. And then the spreadsheet lists the total general fund revenue of additional revenue of about $8 million. Is that a Representative Lesh? The item that's on 112 of the spreadsheet, was that the judicial discretion for waiving surcharges? Is that what 112 is?
Yeah, Representative Lesh. Mr. Chairman, Representative Garofalo, yes, that's correct.
Okay. And so net general, thank you, net general impact, general fund impact here, am I correct in saying, and I'll look at Mr. Marks, is about $100 million above base, 91.4 million plus the 7.9 million?
Ms. Marks.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Garofalo, as far as general fund spending, yes.
Okay. And Mr. Chairman and Mr. Marks, or Chairman Lesh, outside of the general fund, the impact, where do we see on this spreadsheet that number for the non-general fund spending increases?
Mr. Marks, do you want to take that, or shall we ask?
It should be on, Mr.
Okay,
Chair.
We have another fiscal analyst that will perhaps be able to help us with that, if you could identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, the judiciary budget for all the agencies is primarily its general fund only. However, there were a couple impacts on we did create some special revenue funds to receive the proceeds of forfeited property in the forfeiture bill that did not exist previously. That's the only other activity we have outside of general fund spending.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And if I could, just a final question for Representative Lesh.
And by the way, for the record, that was Mr. Walls that made the previous comments. For the record, for the tape. Okay, Representative Ruffle.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And which one of these three bills today is going to be the vehicle that is merged into one? So the Mariani bill will encompass.
I'll be laying this one over like I did the two, and then we'll be folding them into the Mariani bill.
Okay. So, well, Mr. Chairman, I'll talk about the fiscal matters on this bill, but obviously that is. There's some very provocative and controversial language in the Mariani bill, and I'm not going to. I'll save it for that discussion there. But this bill, we're talking about once again a bill where the general fund impact is well over 10% of an increase in spending. This is unsustainable spending, even with tax increases. You cannot have government spending growing at a faster rate than personal income growth and population growth. It's not a Republican or Democrat issue. It's math. And so we're seeing in this bill, once again, we're seeing government grow at a faster rate than the private economy, and it's unsustainable, and we'll. But I'll save my other comments. Because when this bill gets merged to the other bill, I think there's going to be some more serious objections to what we're voting on. But thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Representative Walsh.
Any further discussion? Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Lesh, I was just curious if you could clear up a question for me regarding early neutral evaluation that generally refers to, as you were mentioning, divorcing situations. But I was wondering in the bill here why a contract is given to the University of Minnesota Board of Regents to conduct a study. Can you tell me just a little bit more about that?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Hertas, I don't recall discussion about why it's the regents per se. I know that they've identified the U as being in a unique position to conduct this study. We heard about that from several folks. There were objections as well from members of the family law bar saying that, no, we don't need any changes in family law. It's working just fine. But the U has been doing studies like this, so that's why it's going to the U.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Lesh.
Okay, any further discussion? Seeing none, then I'll lay the bill over for possible or for inclusion in the next House file, which is being identified as Representative Mariani's bill, but technically it's House File 2792.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Representative Mariani being the chair and the chief author. I'll give you a chance to get settled in at the table, Representative Mariani. And Representative Mariani, would you care to move the division report?
Mr. Chair, members, I move adoption of the Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform, Finance, and Policy Division Report for House File 2792.
Mr. Chairman, I would request a roll call on that motion. I'd like to discuss that. To vote it, please.
Okay, there's a roll call been requested. Any discussion on the motion? This is the one where we're simply adopting the division report. Representative Groffo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I inadvertently referred to this as the Mariani bill earlier. I probably shouldn't have done that. I should have referred to it as House File 2792. But that being said, I want to let you, Representative Mariani, and others know I take the consequences of this bill very seriously. Okay? This is not some sort of tinfoil hat, right-wing conspiracy theory that people are coming for our guns. It is real. It is absolutely real. As recently as 10 years ago, it was not the law of this country. The law of this country was, there was an interpretation of it, that my right to own a firearm was somehow tied to being in a militia, that I did not have an individual right to own a firearm. And thank goodness with the Heller decision, the U.S. Supreme Court rightfully ruled that I, as an individual, independent of any membership in a militia, have a constitutional right to own a firearm. The provisions in this bill are regarding gun control are divisive, they're controversial, and they're wrong. The reality is law enforcement has the tools available right now to protect society from those who are mentally ill, disturbed, or shouldn't be in the possession of guns. They have that ability right now. The presumption of the burden of proof should not rely on the citizen to prove they're reliable to own a gun. The burden of proof should rely on the state to take that away. The so-called universal background checks provision in this bill is nothing more than an attempt to build a national, statewide government gun registry database. Why do we know that? Because when the Obama administration studied the regulation of private transactions, what did they say? They said private gun transactions, the only way they could enforce it was with a government database of tracking it. Now, the other side will say, well, this is happy talk. It's not that big of a deal. Keep in mind, every Democratic Party's presidential candidate for the last 20 years has held that previously held view that the right to own a firearm is tied to militia membership, not as an individual. So this is not some sort of extreme fanatical viewpoint that we need to be paranoid about. Hillary Clinton held that view when she ran for president in 2016, and I suspect that next year's Democratic Party candidate for president will hold the same way. These are attacks on our personal freedoms, our individual liberties, and our right to bear arms. I am 100% confident that the membership of the Minnesota State Senate will not allow these provisions to become law. That being said, it concerns me that one party is so interested and so freely willing to take away my rights as an American. So, Mr. Chairman, for that reason and other reasons, I would ask members of this committee to vote no on this division report. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, and we'll have ample opportunity to debate the bill, but this is a procedural motion to begin to get the bill before us. So the clerk will take the...
Mr. Chair, can you clarify that? What exactly does this vote mean? Does this mean you're agreeing with...
We're adopting the division report And then the second motion that will follow would be to move the bill.
So, Mr. Chair,
we're just putting the division report before us. I would say that my take on that is it's a procedural motion to get the division report before us. I don't view it personally as
Mr. Chair.
One way or another for the bill. It will come later.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Just clarification on that. We did have this debate in Education Finance with the division report, and Patrick McCormick was up, and he explicitly said a vote to a yes vote on this is a vote that you agree with the division report as in front of us and as amended. So I just think the members should be clear that a yes vote on this is agreeing with what's in the division report. A no vote is disagreeing with what's in the report. So I think we should be clear on it's not just a procedural thing. It is a vote of affirmation.
All except if that's what our chief counsel has indicated. If you recall, my words were that, in my view, I said that I didn't view it as a vote on the bill. But if Mr. McCormick, who is our expert on these, indicates that it is, then
his words not mine, sir.
Yeah, it'll be up to the members then to determine how they perceive the vote. Clerk will take the roll.
Representative Carlson?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Garofalo?
No.
Representative Albright?
No.
Representative Bernardi?
Aye.
Representative Davids?
No.
Representative Dabney?
Aye.
Representative Juskowski?
No.
Representative Eklund?
No.
Representative Hamilton?
No.
Representative Hansen?
Aye.
Representative Hausman?
Yes.
Representative Hertas?
No.
Representative Hornstein? Representative Grisha?
No.
Representative Liebling?
Yes.
Representative Lilly? Representative Long?
Yes.
Representative Mariani?
Yes.
Representative Marquardt? Representative Nelson? Representative Neuer?
Yes.
Representative Pawlowski?
Yes.
Representative Poppy?
Yes.
Representative Schumacher? Representative Scott?
No.
Representative Torkelson?
No.
Representative Vogel?
No.
Representative Wagenius?
Yes.
Representative Lilly, this is a motion to adopt the division report.
Very much in favor.
Being 14 ayes and 11 nays, the division report is adopted. Representative Mariani, do you have another motion?
Mr. Chair, I do. I'd like to move the A60 amendment.
First of all, we move the bill.
Oh, I'm sorry. You're right.
Just a step ahead.
This is I jumped on ahead. Mr. Chair, members, I move that House File 2792, as amended, be recommended to be placed on the general register.
Okay, that sure. Motion is before us, and now we have an author's amendment, Representative Mariani.
Mr. Chair, I would move the A60 amendment.
Representative Albright.
Mr. Chair, and I would request a roll call on the motion to bring the bill to the general register.
Okay, that will... That motion is before us. We're not voting on it yet.
I'm sorry. Yep.
But remind me of that later so we don't have any mix-ups like we had
yesterday.
Representative Mariani, you have an author's amendment. Representative Mariani, would you care to move the amendment?
Mr. Chair, yes. I would move the A60 amendment. And, Mr. Chair, I'd like to offer a very brief oral amendment to it. It's just an error in drafting the language before us, and I'd ask Mr. Sullivan to explain that very quickly.
I think you can just incorporate that, but,
yes.
Mr. Sullivan.
Mr. Chair and members, the change on the A60 amendment is on page 2, line 6, and the change is before 19,000, insert reduced by, and before 131,000, insert increased by. So the line 2.6, as modified by the author's incorporated change, would read, page 7, line 21, delete reduced by $19,000, and insert increased by $131,000.
Okay, and Representative Mariani has incorporated that in his amendment. Any discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, then, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Representative Mariani, the A58 amendment?
Mr. Chair, I would move the A58 amendment.
Okay, that motion is before us. Representative Mariani, on the amendment.
Mr. Chair, it's a pretty simple amendment. It says that the appropriation, if there's an appropriation in this act that's enacted more than once, the 2019 session, the appropriation must be given effect only once.
Okay, any discussion? Seeing none, then, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Representative Mariani, would you care to explain the bill?
Mr. Chair, members, I'm really proud to present the 2019 House Public Safety Criminal Justice Reform Omnibus Finance Bill. This year, our House committee focused on the theme of community-centered public safety. In state appropriation terms, that means that we continue to fund our corrections and policing functions while also funding both systems and community-based interventions to prevent crimes, to remediate for crime, and to equip offenders to become productive citizens and community builders. This bill is a product of a broad range of Minnesotans that includes conservative and liberal citizen groups as well as county attorneys working on probation reform, the ACLU and other civil liberties groups working on reforming fines and fees, labor representatives working to keep our prisons safe for both guards and inmates, communities of color and indigenous communities stepping up to police their communities effectively, protect their civil rights, and create positive interventions with youth, and survivors of sexual assault working on holding the prosecution of offenses holding the prosecution of crimes against them accountable to their voice while advancing awareness and prevention of these crimes. Together, these diverse Minnesotans over the course of several months shaped a bill that invests state resources to lift the voices of those affected by crime, address systemic issues by reforming systemic issues, prioritizes preventative over punitive measures, engages in transparent problem solving, and decriminalizes poverty. Mr. Chair, members, the major fiscal features of the bill include that the bill itself comes in at the established target set by this body for the next biennium and in our tails. We spend $121.4 million over the general fund base. That reflects a $7.1 million appropriation over the governor's request. The bill funds the Department of Corrections, including our state prisons and the Department of Public Safety, including our Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, or BCA. It provides for all of the governor's initiatives, with exceptions of providing for 110 new correction guards instead of the 120 in his proposal, and we phase those in over 4 years. Vital public servants are covered in this budget, including state prison guards and investigative agents at the BCA. The bill also funds the Office of Justice Programs with $3.7 million in one-time funding for youth intervention, domestic abuse prevention, community policing grants, and ongoing funding for statewide sex trafficking prevention. The bill funds emergency management and communications networks work and the school safety center. The bill extends out for another year the police training dollars currently set to sunset at the end of the next biennium in order to keep investing in the skill development of our peace officers. This is a $6 million commitment beyond the present sunset and is reflected in our tails. Due to decreasing revenue from the special revenue fund that collects traffic fines, there is a shortfall now and into the future for maintaining the operations of the Pulse Board. This bill transfers those revenues and base Pulse Board expenditures into the general fund. The bill does include provisions related to gun regulations, including the background check, an extreme risk protection order, and also provision related to private prison preemption. This bill, members, maintains and grows vital services to keep our public safety, including police training, probation services, emergency management, and first responder communications. We worked really hard and in as inclusive manner as we could over the course of the last several months to create a public safety criminal justice reform finance bill that is driven by multi-party work. I urge your adoption of our work and movement of the bill to the general body for its consideration, and I stand for any questions you may have.
Okay, any discussion on the bill, House File 2792? Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mariani, is there anything in this bill to address the issue? I know there's a shortage of people to be correction officers. There's a lot of vacancies that need to be filled there, and I'm wondering what you did in this bill to address that problem.
Representative Mariani.
Mr. Chair and Representative Scott, we did a couple of things. One, I already mentioned that we appropriated for the ability to have the department fill in the shortage that they have. A number of us visited Stillwater Prison right at the beginning of session and heard directly from guards and staff, as well as inmates. And there was, you know, quite frankly, a lot of you know, agreement. There was a lot of tension, for sure, between the two or three groups because of the tragic event there, death there at the end of the year. But there was agreement that a shortage of guards meant that that facility, the people in it who worked in it, who lived there, did not feel safe. The need for guards to be present in sufficient numbers makes it possible to do the kind of programming that gives some purpose of meaning and structure for the inmates in the facilities, which contributes to safety. In addition to that, this bill invests in the beginning stages of doing some strong interventions for, quite frankly, mental health supports and counseling, particularly for our guards. We were struck by the nature of pain and, to some degree, a feeling of being isolated and left out, being left out of opportunities to express their grief upon the loss of their colleague. And they told us pretty directly that kind of environment makes it very difficult to recruit individuals into the facility. And so trying to create a place where the word gets out in the general population that if you work here, you've got to be supported. The institution has your back. It's providing professional services to deal with what admittedly is a very highly stressful environment and vocation. So those are two things that this bill does to be able to address that issue. There has been ongoing conversations between the Commissioner of Corrections and the representatives of the guards to continue to work on working conditions and pay conditions for them that hopefully will lead to making that profession a much more attractive for prospective candidates.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so could you explain this backfilling process a little bit to me? Because my understanding is that some of those funds to fill those positions has been used elsewhere. Do you know anything about that?
Representative Mariani.
Mr. Chair and Representative Scott, that perhaps might be a better question for the Commissioner of Corrections. I think you can provide much more detailed insight to that, and I would certainly.
Is he present? Yeah, there we go. Okay. And And Mr. Schnell, if you could identify yourself for the record.
Paul Schnell, Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Corrections. Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, to your question, the existing funds have not been used for other purposes with one exception, and that is overtime to backfill current vacancies. So we have not used or diverted funds for any other purpose other than to cover open spots. And so we have used dollars that would normally be allocated for personnel to overtime to fill fill holes in our schedule throughout our facilities.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that response, Commissioner Schnell. And I'm concerned about the starting pay and the pay scale for these people. They have a really, really tough job. And some of them live in my district, and they've been in my office before, and you know, they're taking their lives into their own hands every day, really. It's a tough job. So what does this bill do to increase the starting pay and kind of condense the salaries, pay scale going forward? Representative Mariani.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, I'm just looking for some language here really quick. Relative to your question, I believe. Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, if you look on page 20.32, so this is in the writer's section of the bill, under staffing, recruitment, and retention, we're providing $4 million each year for staffing and recruitment and retention activities, so we can certainly have the commissioner speak to what his plans are relative to that.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'd be interested in hearing that.
Welcome back.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, there are a number of things that are being addressed. Certainly, there is the contracts are open now, so the bargaining units are actively engaged in collective bargaining with the state. We are certainly having conversations. We are aware of the differences between the starting pay, for instance, that the state has and many of the counties, and that is definitely a priority. We are also have changed our hiring protocols, processes. Right now, presently or previously, anybody who applied for a job as a corrections officer would need to come to central office. We are beginning, in fact, this next week, we will start regional hiring processes at Minnesota Correctional Facility in Faribault. We'll hold a localized recruitment event where candidates would be able to come, hear about the position, apply, interview and initiate the background process, and we believe that we would be able to turn these make offers within a matter of days to complete that background investigation instead of the weeks or months that it had taken in the past. And we also have identified processes to get candidates into the academy much quicker, because we're up against a lot of other industries that are able to hire oftentimes on the spot and get people started.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Commissioner Schnell. So $4 million each year for staffing, recruitment, and retention. And so are you then doing anything to increase the starting salaries for these folks?
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, we are in the midst of having conversations. We are prepared to have those conversations, and we're working with the union to have those discussions to bring that starting pay up.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further discussion? Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And beyond the concerns over the size and scope of government and raising taxes, higher spending that's in this bill, I do want to focus on my concerns about the gun control portions in this bill. What has happened here is the DFL has chosen conflict over cooperation. It's chosen confrontation over consensus and is deciding on coercion instead of collaboration. And it's that last word I want to focus on, coercion. Members, I don't whine about process around here. The reality is that the majority party uses the appropriations process as leverage to get the policy they want. It's something you do in the negotiation process to get the other side of the aisle to work with you. Complaining about that is something the minority political party does. Both sides of the aisle have used this as a tool. But this bill is coercion for another reason. The inclusion of these gun control amendments in this bill are for one reason and one reason only. You don't have the votes. There are 9 members of the House DFL caucus who do not want to vote for those gun control bills. It's the worst-kept secret at the Capitol right now. Those 9 members, combined with the 59 members of the Republican caucus, compromise a majority of the legislative chamber that can defeat these gun control measures. But rather than allow a stand-up vote on the bill, you are coercing your own members, not us. You are coercing DFL members who do not want to vote for this bill by tucking it into an omnibus bill and making it a referendum on supporting your House leadership. That is unfair to those House DFL members, and it's unfair to the citizens of Minnesota. I am opposed to these gun control bills, but if you want to have a debate about gun control, if you want to get burned at the election box taking people's guns like you always have since the 1990s, bring it on. I jokingly, back in 2013, someone asked me a question, do you think the Democrats, with their new legislative majorities and total control of the state, are they going to pass gun control? And my comment to the reporter was, only if they were stupid. That was back in 2013, and to Speaker Thiessen's credit and the DFL majorities, they knew not to do it. And yet, here we are, 6 years later, thank goodness we have a Senate Republican majority protect us, but we have a DFL turning on its own members, forcing these controversial policy provisions into an omnibus bill to exert coercion and pressure on their own members to make them vote for it. So I'm a no on this bill. I want to thank the bipartisan opposition to these provisions. I know the next couple of weeks are not going to be easy for those DFL members who oppose it, but I ask them to hold strong, and together we're going to defeat these initiatives, and we're going to protect our Second Amendment rights in this state. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any further discussion? Representative Albright, I think this is the point where your earlier request comes into play.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would request a roll call on the motion.
Okay, the motion is before us, and there will be a slightly different motion because this is going to be folded in, but you'll have your vote. Representative Mariani, would you like to move that the language contained in House File 2792 as amended be included in a separate article in the omnibus bill?
Mr. Chair, I would so move.
Okay, and this avoids the problem that we had yesterday because there now will be a vote on the Mariani bill, and then we will have a series of motions pending the outcome of this vote that will incorporate the other ones that were laid over. So any discussion on the motion?
Mr. Chair. Okay.
Representative Mariani.
Just very quickly, I certainly appreciate the passion that Representative Garofalo brings to this conversation. It's not the first time I've heard it, and won't be the last, and that's okay. But I would hope, members, that we don't let those passions eclipse what truly has been an incredibly strong effort to find common space in lots of other areas. The bill itself is full of works that spring from the work of the prior majority. We gave a lot of room and daylight to review the hard work that had been done in the previous biennium that was pushed out by the now minority party at that time when they controlled this body. We also created pretty smart, effective, objective opportunities for members of the committee from both sides of the party, or both sides of the aisle, rather, to work on some really important legislation, including efforts to reform our sexual assault investigation and prosecution work in our state, and also on probation reform issues as well. I absolutely, totally understand how people need to vote on this based on the other provisions of this bill, but I certainly want to remind us that there is a lot of common people's work that exists at the core of this bill. It's been a real privilege to have led that effort, and I look forward to continuing this debate and delivering on those, especially those areas where there is really a lot of agreement across the aisle. So. With that, Mr. Chair.
Okay, the clerk will take the roll.
Representative Carlson?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Garofalo?
No.
Representative Albright?
No.
Representative Bernardi?
Yes.
Representative Davids?
No.
Representative Dabney?
Aye.
Representative Drazkowski?
No.
Representative Eklund? Representative Hamilton?
No.
Representative Hansen?
Yes.
Representative Hausman?
Yes.
Representative Hertas?
Oh, no.
Representative Hornstein? Representative Kreisha?
No.
Representative Liebling?
Oh, yes.
Representative Lilly?
Yes.
Representative Long?
Yes.
Representative Mariani?
Yes.
Representative Marquardt? Representative Nelson? Representative Neuer?
Yes.
Representative Pawlowski?
Yes.
Representative Poppy?
Yes.
Representative Shoemaker? Representative Scott?
No.
Representative Torkelson?
No.
Representative Vogel?
No.
Representative Wagenius?
Yes.
And Representative Nelson?
Yes.
Being 15 ayes and 10 nays, the motion prevails. We'll now go to a motion by Representative Pawlowski. Would you like to move that House File 2792 be incorporated, or that we incorporate the language in House File 2611 as amended as a separate article? Representative Pawlowski. So moves. Any discussion? Seeing none, then, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion carried. Representative Nora, would you like to move to incorporate the language contained in House File 2705 as amended into House File 2792 as a separate article? Representative Nora.
I so move.
Okay, that motion is before us. Any discussion? Seeing none, then, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion carried. Representative Mariani renews his motion that House File 2792, as amended, be recommended to be placed on the General Register and that the staff be directed to make the technical corrections and amend the title. That motion is before us. Any discussion? Seeing none, then, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carried. Members, we have Representative Dean's bill up next. There he is. I was looking for him in the audience. So House File 2792, I don't remember if I said carried, but it did carry. Representative Olson.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move
House File 1543.
House File 1543, the first engrossment be recommended to be placed on the General Register.
Okay, the motion is before us, and there is an author's amendment. Do you want to take the author's amendment now?
Mr. Chair, yeah, if someone could move that for me, that would be great. I'm happy to explain it if you'd like that.
Yeah, we'll move it
first. After it's moved, great.
Representative Olson?
I will move the A3 amendment for the author.
Okay, that motion is before us. Representative Dean.
So thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm bringing forward this amendment because there was some concern raised by actually the number two author on the bill. In the GOP, that the language was not tight enough in the original bill as far as who would be covered from the ability to actually get a set aside from the disqualification. So that's why this before us. Well, I'll talk a little bit more about the bill when we actually get to the bill. So again, this is meant to actually add clarity and tighten the original intent of the bill.
Okay, any discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, then, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carried. Representative Dean on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members. House File 1543 is a iteration of a bill that was previously carried by Representative Lohmer. We've done some things to sort of tighten up the language in the original draft of the bill, and now with the additional language in the amendment. And what the bill does is it allows individuals to get a set aside from a disqualification to work within the substance use and disorder treatment field. We're at a crisis. I mean, we've been talking a lot about opioid addiction and other addictions this past session, and we're in a crisis. We're in a crisis where we have a need out there, and unfortunately, a lot of the individuals who could play a significant role as counselors to counsel individuals dealing with addiction are currently unable to get set-asides from that disqualification because of a past criminal history. And one of the things the bill does is it makes it real clear that these are for nonviolent crimes. If you look at references 254C.15, which calls out many of those provisions that don't allow for the set-aside, and we've added several more as well. And I'm, you know, a little bit confused why there might be resistance, but I've heard there might be resistance. In the end, this is a great need in our community. And as someone who a long, 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 long time ago was going through a chemical dependency treatment center, when people have addictions, it's really hard for them to give credibility to individuals who may not have had similar life experiences that they have had. This is intended to make sure that those individuals that have turned their lives around, almost all of them, that they've gone through education to become a counselor in a center, that they have the ability to get that position. Two things to make clear. This is only for facilities that only service individuals 18 years and older, so this wouldn't be for adolescent centers. And it does another thing that I think is critical, is once an individual gets a set aside from the disqualification, should they change jobs, they don't have to go through the whole process again, and their employer doesn't have to go through the whole process of getting an exemption for them to work there. So I think this is a great bill. I think it will help a lot of need, and I open myself up for questions if members have it.
Any questions on the bill as amended? Representative Liebler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Dean. As I'm looking at your amendment that we adopted, the A3, and just fitting it into the bill, I just have a question. The 245C.15 is referred to a couple of times in the bill. Can you just remind us of what is in Section 245C.15? It's on line 3.1 of the bill, line 3.2. It talks about that the individual is not disqualified under those sections, and I just wonder what those sections are.
Representative
Liebling, 245C.15 talks about permanent disqualifications, and it ranges from violation of a predatory offender registration law, murder in the first degree, murder in the second degree, murder in the third degree, manslaughter in the first degree. There's actually quite a long, exhaustive list. I'm happy to go through all of them if you'd like, but we've made very clear that individuals that have done crimes that most people would consider heinous and troubling are not going to be able to get a set-aside through this process. This is really meant to create those individuals that probably have what many people might consider lower-level offenses, the ability to actually work and try to help other individuals who are entering treatment to get to recovery as well.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Dean. I thought that might be the case, and I just wanted to make sure that that was clarified. Thank you, and I appreciate the additional language as well.
Okay, any further discussion?
Mr. Chair, I renew my motion that House File 1543, the first engrossment as amended, be recommended to be placed on the general register.
Okay, any further discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. Motion carried. Tomorrow, members, we will be meeting at approximately 9:30. Not 1900 hours, 9:30 or after session. Was session at 9:30? I thought it was 9. We will meet 15 minutes after session. And what we will be taking up tomorrow, just for members' information, is taxes, state government, finance, veterans affairs, and a couple of smaller standalone bills. They've all been posted. And then we are going to be tomorrow amending the budget resolution. So we'll probably do the budget resolution first tomorrow, and then maybe take up veterans. And we may give time for about a half-hour caucus before we take up the tax committee or the tax bill. So both caucuses will have a few minutes to visit about the tax bill. So with that, if there is no further business, meeting adjourned.